360's The Week That Was, the most listened to hour in Territory Radio. The Territory leaders break down this week's big issues.
And it is time for The Week That Was, and joining us in the studio this morning, we do know that The Week That Was is proudly brought to you now by De Silva Hebron, your local lawyers, and we're also now broadcasting in Alice Springs from midday today. And joining us in the studio, Matt Cunningham from Sky News. Good morning.
G'day, Katie. How are you?
Very well. We've got Leah Finocchiaro, the opposition leader. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Friday.
And we've got Natasha Files, the health minister and minister for tourism. Good morning.
Morning, Wolfie.
Well, what a morning. It's always an interesting morning on a Friday. I enjoy my Friday mornings with everybody in here. Now, unfortunately, overnight, I will just start with some of the overnight crime. Matt Hepworth spoke with the watch commander a little earlier today, and we know that a 28-year-old woman has been injured in a frightening home invasion in Bayview overnight. An unknown man allegedly broke into the Bradhurst Court home at about 12:30 this morning. As he was leaving, he was met at the front door by the 28-year-old woman who lives in the home, returning home. The man then smashed a bottle of alcohol over her head before fleeing the scene. Remarkably, the woman only sustained minor lacerations. Now, the police are searching for the offender. He's described as a young Indigenous male, a tall, slim build, wearing a grey shirt and jeans. Anyone with further info is urged to contact the police. I'm also of the understanding that there was another incident, a stabbing, I believe, in the city outside Woolworths. So we are just trying to get a bit more detail on that one. But I tell you what, this story about the home invasion in Bayview is certainly a frightening one. I know that it's something we hear quite a bit of, obviously, on the show. We talk about crime nearly every week on The Week That Was as well. But I tell you what, you'd be pretty bloody frightened if you arrived home, there's somebody, you know, coming out of your house and then they actually injure you with a bottle.
It's terrifying, Katie, and my, you know, heart goes out to that poor woman who obviously was not expecting that to happen. And thank goodness, as you said, Katie, there's only relatively minor injuries. But it again goes to the core of this issue of people wanting to feel safe in their home and in their community. And the fact that things like this are happening, I mean, the stabbing, I heard some details earlier of that horrific stabbing in the CBD. I mean, we've had, I think it was 8 vehicles smashed at Alice Springs Hospital. I mean, these instances just go on and on. Anyone you speak to can name people who've been victims of crime, and yet nothing seemingly is being done. This government seems fixated on other areas that are nowhere near as important as keeping people safe. We talk about it, I mean, I don't even know what to say anymore about this, Katie. We've got our plans and our positions on what we think the government needs to do, what laws need to change, but ultimately the government needs to listen and they don't want to. And, you know, we spent the last 2 weeks in Parliament trying to talk about crime and just getting our debates squashed. So I don't know what else people can do to let this government know it's not okay.
I feel a bit the same. You know, even yesterday we caught up with the police minister, Nicole Manison. She was on the show. I spoke to her about a number of different things that, you know, that we've had reported to us here on the show. The thing that I've found really quite concerning in recent weeks is that, to me, there seems to be a bit of a situation where we've got teenagers who are targeting seniors. Yes. On Monday in Casuarina, there was an 80-year-old woman who had her bag stolen. Now, I guess you could look at that and go, well, do you know what? It's not a big deal. It's your bag. You know, that sort of thing happens at different times. But add to that the situation that had unfolded last week in Alice Springs, where there was an elderly woman who had been accosted at an ATM. There was also a man who was having a coffee, I believe, at a cafe in the mall in Alice Springs. He'd had his wallet stolen and then he was knocked over. You know, the fact is, whether the government wants to see it or not, we've got a real issue at the moment. And you know, the talk of generational change, everybody really understands that. And it is 100%. True. We do need to have generational change. But if something isn't changed at this point as well, I reckon we're going to see people leaving town.
There'll be no one left. Yeah. There'll be no one left in a generation, you know. And the fact in Alice Springs, you know, we had the message coming out that seniors should be walking around in pairs. I mean, this is just crazy. Businesses are being told, oh, well, you should have roller doors. You should have this type of security. I mean, we're all barricading ourselves into our businesses, our homes, our lives. We're now having to go out in pairs. We can't go out after dark. We can't go into the mall. We can't do all these things. And it's all because of a few people doing the wrong thing that the government doesn't want to deal with. It's like, why does everyone have to change their life and their enjoyment of and just feeling safe, you know? Like this woman from last night, how do you think every time she comes home now, you know, how is she going to feel? She's going to be reminded of that incident for a very long time, and that's devastating and traumatizing for her and for other people who hear that story, and that's not okay.
Matt, you've done quite an extensive amount of work over the last week or so on some of the impacts that we've seen as a result of COVID payments going into the community. And anecdotally, we've spoken quite a bit about this as well in recent weeks and recent months. I know that you've spoken to the police commissioner, amongst others, about the impact of these increased payments and really what it's seen, I suppose, in a number of different areas.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that incident that you're talking about overnight in Bayview, I'm not sure that we can draw a direct link, but there's certainly plenty of evidence that points to what's going on here. And what our investigation has shown through documents we obtained from Ken Wyatt, the Minister for Indigenous Australians' office, is that there were a range of unintended consequences when those payments were made. Now, they included a surge in alcohol consumption, a surge in people moving from communities into town. Now, we saw that in Alice Springs. Last Friday night, Katie, I was walking around in Alice Springs at midnight, and I can tell you there would have been close to 100 kids walking the streets, and some of them are 8 and 9 years old.
Are you serious?
You look at the incident overnight in Alice from yesterday that the police put a press release out about the criminal damage of 8 cars in Alice Springs. The alleged offenders in that case were 11 and 9 years old.
Yeah,
I mean, that is something that should be of huge concern to us. And then I think what you think we're seeing, and people on the ground are saying this, is you've got police on the bottle shops in Alice Springs, Tennant Creek and Catherine. So now we're seeing people move to Darwin where it's easier to get alcohol. And the other thing you're seeing, and the police commissioner said this as well, is you're seeing those payments come off. They're going to the increased payments will be gone by the end of this month. And so then it's likely that we're going to see an increase in crime as people search for alcohol. And so I think what you see going on there in Bayview last night is a desperate person looking for alcohol who commits a horrible crime against an innocent woman.
It's pretty unbelievable. I want to go back to those young people that are on the streets. Even throughout the week as well, we'd heard about the situation. I believe that it was in Nucky Camp earlier in the week where the watch commander had, again, told Matt Hepworth when he was doing his rounds in the morning that a young girl, a 15-year-old, if I remember correctly, had to be then taken into protective custody with the police because they'd gone there. She was intoxicated. She ended up spitting on the police and didn't have family to care for her. You know, I think that we all, like, that's the point, I guess, that we all really understand, is that sometimes we are talking about situations here where kids are not safe. You know, like, they're, if you've got 9 and 10-year-olds on the streets in Alice Springs, you're talking about kids just not being safe. And that's where I wonder, you know, obviously we've got a duty of care to those kids to make sure that they're safe, but we've also got a duty of care to every Territorian to make sure that then there's not young people who are mugging elderly women.
Yeah, exactly. And this is why I always bring up Territory families and their role in this and the fact that youth justice should not be sitting with Territory families because they have to just focus on care and protection of children. And this was raised again in Parliament last week and, you know, sort of just discarded by government. It's like if an 8 or 9 year old, I mean, to use the example of the 9 year old who's allegedly breaking into those 8 cars at Alice Springs Hospital overnight, and the paper I think reported that you know, that 9 year old was just taken home. Now if a 9 year old is out on the street in the middle of the night smashing up cars, there's got to be some issue deeper there. There's got to be a deeper issue going on. And so what role is Territory families having to make sure that everything's okay or that that child is safe? I mean, we hear the government talk a lot about family responsibility agreements, yet they haven't been established and put in place to have that sort of contractual arrangement between the department and the parent about what their obligation is to their child and vice versa. So there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. And I just think that by having youth justice in with Territory families, it's really conflicted that agency and confused their resourcing and their ability to respond on the two separate fronts. You've got the youth justice side, the pointy end, those kids need to be dealt with through a correction system, and then you've got the kids who need that support and the families more so, and that's where care and protection comes in.
Katie, we know the strong correlation between young people caught up in the youth justice system and child protection notifications, and they come from that child protection system. We, Leah and I, have debated this before. We've got a fundamental point of difference. We believe that the youth justice needs to sit in territory families, the work around the Royal Commission. So just putting a line in the sand there, you've got two different points of view, and there's no point getting into a debate on that. But for us, we have seen a decrease in those child protection notifications. All of these incidents are unacceptable, and this is long grind, hard work, and the Minister for Territory Families, Kate Warden, is doing an exceptional job. She is getting out on the beach. She's trying to work with the NGOs. She's trying to provide more resources, and these are complex. It's not just around, you know, making sure that there's strong policies in place. You need to have the resources for when people come into town. So Batten Road accommodation, for example, so there's a safe place for families that come in on legitimate business, making sure that there is measures in place for young people that start to go off on the wrong track, making sure that there's those supports to those families. But these are difficult issues.
I just feel like I don't know, honestly, you know, I don't know what else to say, because I've reached a point, as I think so many of our listeners have at the moment, where, you know, where there's the government's message isn't changing in this space in any way. And I understand that, you know, that you and Leah have obviously got very much fundamental different views when it comes to the way in which we deal with young people and that youth justice space. But right now, you know, the number of messages and the number of people we've had call through and message to say, you know, where's your duty of care, or where, you know, they understand that generational change needs to happen, but they're wondering, you know, what the government is going to do to help them as well. And I think, you know, not to bang on about the incident from last night, and I actually don't know whether it's a young offender or how old the offender was, but I think that the point is that, you know, we've got this situation at the moment where there's some people who simply don't feel safe, and that is not the way that you want the community to feel. We all understand that there's going to be an element of crime all the time. We don't live in utopia. You know, we're not going to have a situation where there's never going to be anything, you know, any
bad instance, things will happen.
That's exactly right. We all get that. But I just don't seem, like, I just am finding it really hard to understand why the government is not budging in any way on some of these things, particularly if you take into account then what Matt has said. You know, with these payments, with these COVID payments ending, if we're then anticipating that we could see another spike in crime, if we're not dealing with these, or if we don't have a bit of a rethink about the way that we're doing stuff, nothing's going to change.
When you talk about people being safe, Wolfie, I think that's a really good point. And I think that we should also have a priority about the safety of those kids who are on the street, right? So when I walked around the streets of Alice Springs at midnight, I didn't witness any criminal behaviour. I reckon 90% of those kids were happy, smiling, you know, kids who, you know, should have bright futures in front of them. But all of the research says that they're not going to have a bright future in front of them if they're, one, not going to school, and, you know, if they're wandering the streets at 1 o'clock in the morning. Mm. And so that, I think that's where we need to try and look after these kids to make sure that they have the best possible future. I know Robin Lamley had proposed, you know, having this situation, because at the moment what the police do, and the police are working overtime with these kids on the streets, but they're pushing them to the youth hub, right? But then they go to the youth hub, and at a certain point they just go back out of the youth hub and back out onto the street. So, I mean, Robin Lamley was proposing a situation where you actually put beds in the youth hub, and at 12 o'clock you get all the kids in there and you say, okay, here's a bed for you, here's a safe place for you to stay tonight. Because the other disturbing thing about this, and Jamie Chalker said this, is that, you know, in a lot of cases, those kids are out on the street at midnight and 1 a.m. because they feel safer on the street than they do in their own home.
Which is just astonishing.
Exactly, and that comes back to territory families and the care and protection of children and the role they're playing. You know, Matt, I was out on the Saturday night as well, and you're right, there's just heaps of kids everywhere, and they're sort of playing. It's almost like the CBD has become a playground, you know, and everyone can understand. Obviously, something is going on at home, but I think that's why it's not okay for the government to just sort of, I just don't know what is going on. Clearly, and not enough is being done in that space, and we've got more resourcing than ever before, particularly Alice Springs. When you walk around, there are police everywhere, Matt. I don't know if you saw that. There are territory family, you know, Yorits driving around, you know, it's the security guards as well.
Yes, So then where's it breaking down? Where if you've got a situation where there's kids who aren't safe and that they are on the street, where's it then breaking down? You know, if the police are obviously there, everybody can see, like you said, Matt, in some instances they might not be breaking the law or doing anything wrong. But, you know, the reality is you shouldn't have an 8 or 9-year-old out on the street at midnight. So how, where's the duty of care then as well in terms of making sure that they do have somewhere safe to go? And if they don't have somewhere safe to go, then what are we actually doing?
Well, that then comes back to Territory families. And that's why I keep banging on about this, because it's like, at what point is that a care and protection of children issue? You know, especially if that child is known to Territory families, if work has been done with the parents and the family or carers before, you know, there's got to be more to the story. And I just think we don't hear enough from Territory families around what exactly it is they're doing and their role in this. Well, and it's just not okay to have 50 to 100 kids out on the street in the middle of the night.
Well, I'd suggest that if an 8 or 9-year-old kid is out on the street at 1 o'clock in the morning, then that family should be known to Territory families.
Exactly.
You know, I would like to think that if my 8 or 9-year-old child was wandering around the streets at 1 o'clock in the morning, that I'd be getting a knock on the door from Territory families and saying, what on earth is going
on?
Yeah. You know, there's an issue here with parenting, and, you know, what we've certainly found, Katie, is that this is an issue. I mean, these are issues that have all existed previously.
Yeah.
I think with the COVID payments and the early access to superannuation, though, it's been like tipping a bucket of petrol on a campfire. I mean, it's just really exacerbated everything, and we've just seen an increase in these issues, and I think we're just seeing that play out now, but not just in Alice Springs, we're seeing it play out. You know, look at in Tennant Creek, I think the alcohol-related violence, alcohol-related assaults went up more than 50% in a 12-year period.
Domestic
violence is up 20-plus percent across the board. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we're covering today is the impact on school attendance. So in Term 3, 2020, which was the first term after the money had come in and the biosecurity zones were lifted, out of 83 remote and very remote schools, school attendance fell in 71 of those schools. And in some cases, it's fallen to about 20%.
Yeah.
I think that's starting from a low base.
That school attendance, that's, you know, kids, you know, they, like, I think that everyone acknowledges the family nurse partnerships and those families as first teachers programs are working really well and in the preschool. And I was looking at some data the other day that shows your best school attendance is year two, and from there it starts to drop off. And that school attendance, you know, these kids, they should be at school. That's how we, because what happens is they don't attend school, so you can't get consistency in their learning and their literacy and numeracy, you know, just literally being able to do some basic maths and their reading just shifts away, and they don't want to go to school at that point. So I think that the education has a really key role to play in this. And we have seen in Palmerston, the Clontarf program go into the primary schools. And I think that program, you know, I certainly see the benefit of it at my local middle school, but pushing into that primary school, because we're talking about, you know, these issues have been around for decades. Young people will, you know, they want to rebel and they want to have their independence, but the problem is we're seeing it, they're coming younger and younger, and they then don't have, you know, any comprehension of maturity to try and understand the messages. So I think that, you know, those types of programs are certainly very valid.
Well, and again, I reckon, you know, there's a common understanding within this room, and I'm sure with our listeners as well, that there is no doubt that there's some really serious work that needs to happen when it comes to the care and protection of our young people. But then, you know, we've also got this issue that's running parallel where, you know, where we've got crime, break-ins, you know, different issues, even mortifyingly, you know, there was a 17-year-old who had been charged last week after an absolutely horrific video had gone on social media where this young man had allegedly assaulted two men in their 40s, two Indigenous men in their 40s. You know, I spoke about it to the Minister for Police yesterday. If you saw the vision, it actually made you feel sick to the stomach that something like that could happen, let alone then be posted on social media. But, you know, I'll just read a message for you that's come through from one of our listeners this morning, because I think it hits the nail on the head in terms of that issue that's running parallel. And it says, "Hi, Katie, I no longer feel safe here anymore. We moved here over 20 years ago and it was a beautiful, safe place to live. My children have moved away with their families as they don't want their children growing up here, and we're moving away at the end of the year. The government needs to get tough on crime, and a lot more people are going to leave. It's really sad." Says that messenger. Now, I understand that, you know, that the opposition and the government have very differing views in the ways in which we need to deal with the issues we've got with youth crime. You know, stepping away from the child protection and talking about the youth crime. But whatever we do, I cannot say it strongly enough that I just feel that the government needs to take note of what Territorians are saying right now. I mean, I know that sometimes, you know, the government can get cross with the messenger, i.e. me, but I'm not making these stories up. You know, we're not making it up. It's something that we're hearing every single day, and I cannot tell you loudly enough how badly people want their voices to be heard.
And, you know, when you've got 50% of all youth arrested last financial year are on bail at the time that they're arrested, is an astonishing figure. It speaks very loud and clearly for itself. When you've got information from the police commissioner saying that 75% of youth who've been arrested in Alice Springs by Strike Force Viper are repeat offenders. Enormous, enormous statistics there. It shows very clearly, and again, this is talking about that youth justice end, it shows very clearly we've got a problem with repeat offending and with bail, and we have to do something about that. And instead of doing something about that, we've got other sideline issues that the government wants to run to try and sound like they're doing something about crime, but not tackle that core issue. When the data speaks so loudly for itself, I cannot understand how the government can ignore that data and then all of the voices of the people around the territory who want action.
Well, I think, you know, the concerns of victims of crime are very real. I do wonder about whether making the penalties or the punishments tougher is going to have any impact, because there's just the thing is there doesn't seem to be any regard for that
for the
in
law.
The first place. I spoke to Michael Little when I was in Alice Springs, who runs the Code for Life program for Aboriginal men and trying to improve their behaviour. Here's a quote from him. He says, "Our Aboriginal men aren't listening or following either rules. We're not interested in blackfella rules because we're too busy in town having fun, and we're not listening to the whitefella rules when we're in town having fun." And I think that tells us a fair bit, because I think we are seeing that. I think, you know, you could say, well, you know, if you get caught breaking in somewhere, you're going to go to jail for 5 years. I'm not sure that would have an impact. I think we've got a sort of societal breakdown that's going on, and that's what we're seeing playing out on the streets.
But equally, we've got an obligation to keep people safe. So if someone is a repeat offender, they've been given all the diversion opportunities, they've been given all the opportunities to change their life. I mean, that's why, you know, we committed to a sentence to a skill program for youth offenders. You know, it's a longer-term sentence where they can get a skill and hopefully get a job. You know, we've got to be looking at some of these issues, but ultimately, if you have someone with no regard for the law who continues to create victims and continues to destroy other people's lives, we have to deal with that person.
360 is the week that was. Thanks to De Silva Hebron, your local lawyers.
And we are now broadcasting on 8HA in Alice Springs as well. And if you've just joined us, we're joined by Sky News correspondent Matt Cunningham, the opposition leader Leah Finocchiaro, and the Minister for Health and Tourism, Natasha Files. Now, let's talk about park fees, because it has been confirmed that those who want to walk the likes of the Jatbulla Trail, the Larapinta Trail and Tabletop Track are going to have to pay $25 per night, a maximum of up to $125 for five or more nights. This new fee structure is set to be introduced on July 1, but Territorians will still be able to access those walking trails for free if they're undertaking single-day walks or runs. In addition to that, there's also some changes to those camping fees, and I won't go through all the prices right now, but I think the biggest question and the biggest thing that I've heard back from our listeners and others is that people want to make sure that any money that is obviously made through these fees goes back into our parks. By the sounds of things, from a bit of poking around throughout the week, we're going to need to pay off the system that we're creating to book it to begin with.
Exactly. And that's, you know, I've got some very serious doubts about this. The government's being very, you know, cute in the way it talks about the fees going back into the park. But I think the only way we're going to know is come budget time. And if the park's budget is bigger, then that means the money went back into the parks. But otherwise, it's all just spin if you ask me, Katie, and I think it's a slippery slope. And ultimately, if we didn't have an $8.4 billion debt, I don't think the government would be going down this road. I think our tourism industry has suffered terribly from COVID, and anything that could deter interstate visitors from coming here is scary. And we've already heard from tourism coming out saying they want more consultation. And Natasha, I mean, you're the tourism minister. How much consultation has been done with industry over this issue? I think the system's expensive. I'd love to know how long it'll take us to pay it back before we even see any return on investment, if we ever do. And ultimately, I also think it's a slippery slope that under the Gunner government, Territorians will be next to pay.
Falsey, I mean, I know that in the initial stages, there really had been no consultation with our tourism operators, and people were quite concerned about that. Even you had said to me during an interview that, you know, that those tourism operators had raised with you their worries about this being implemented and the impacts it was going to have for them. I don't know whether, you know, whether they're still feeling that way, or are they, you know, Tourism Central Australia had said to me a little earlier in the week, Daniel Rochford had said that they were pleased that the government had sort of had a bit more consultation, but I still wonder how it's going to impact those operators.
So there's been a great deal of work done over the past couple of months, Katie, to make sure tourism operators understand the impact. And we also acknowledge that tourism operators, particularly off the back of COVID, have had bookings deferred and bookings cancelled. And so there is, in terms of tourism operators paying some of those fees, I don't have the specific date, but we have acknowledged that with a moratorium on their fees so that they've got time to build that into their booking system. In terms of the walks, Katie, I've had people approach me saying that they're incredibly frustrated that the walks are free, and people want to do the walk and they want to have it exclusively for their group. So they might have four or five people, and it's, and they know it's 10 people allocated on that day. So they'll make up names because it is so, it's free, like, so that they don't have to, so they can just put in no names. So having this fee,
what, so they can do it on their own with their own group?
Yes. And so I know someone who's tried it for a couple of years to get in when the day the walk's open. So some people have welcomed that small fee because that can act as a deterrent. I know for myself, I enjoy camping, and, you know, I grew up going to Lichfield very regularly. Last dry season was fantastic to be able to get down there and explore it again. And so having this system where you can book your camping spot, you can leave Darwin on a Friday afternoon and be assured that you'll get a camping spot. There is already camping fees, and yes, there is an increase to those. So I think that in terms of communications, accept the criticism, but where we're trying to end up, we'll see more Territorians being able to access our parks.
I have had one tourism operator get in contact with me and wanted a few questions answered, asking how much revenue is currently being raised by camping fees in our parks. Do we have any idea?
I don't have that figure, Katie, but the Parks Minister would be able to provide it.
He also said, will the money for the online booking system come out of the existing parks budget, or is it new funds, i.e. that tender that is currently out at the moment for between $3 and $5 million? In terms of that new system that needs to be created.
Katie, I don't have that in front of me, but happy to chase the Minister for Parks.
I've got a good stat. At $25 a night for a $5 million online booking system, that's 200,000 nights to pay off the booking system alone.
Oh, take us a while.
There you go. A little bit of time there.
I'll pick up.
And I bet you won't do one more, Wolfie.
If this funding is coming out of the park's existing budget, well, will there be rangers or employees laid off to fund this online booking system?
Good question.
If not, where will the funds come from?
So, Katie, our parks are amazing. We've got world-class parks. I love getting out, but there is frustration, and I've outlined two examples there for you from the community. So you can attend parks in other places, and they have, you know, online booking systems so you can be guaranteed that spot. And also make sure you're getting that revenue. At the moment, it's a cash-based system. So if you don't have the right cash when you go down and camp, and, you know, you've got to catch the ranger. So it's making sure that we do see people using these facilities paying
for them. How will it work, given the poor phone coverage that is out in many of these places? How will it work if you're in one spot and then you want to book ahead and book the next spot if you haven't got
your phone coverage?
So my understanding is you make a booking for spots, but then you can also turn up and if there's spots available. So a bit like if you're driving from a roadhouse to a caravan park, you can book ahead if you're sticking to an itinerary for your trip, or you can turn up at a caravan park and hope there's a spot and still check in if there is.
We'll be old and grey by the time 200,000 nights goes by.
Well,
as a keen camper, I'm looking forward to the week that was from one of our parks with of you camping.
Well, listen here, I'm not a real good camper, guys.
Yeah.
Are there any other states that charge just for interstate visitors other than the Northern Territory? I mean, is there the potential Victoria could say, all right, well, screw you, Northern Territory. Mm. You know, we're now going to slug you when you guys come down here and want to go camping.
I don't know, when you go to national parks, you pay. So I hadn't... I only camp in the Territory.
Yeah, I'm really special relationship.
But look, I guess, you know, based on some of the messages that we have received from some of those tourism operators, I guess the thing that they're wondering is they've got a lot more questions. Like, they've certainly got some more questions in terms of exactly how it's going to be rolled out, how it's going to impact them, and, you know, whether maybe there should be a bit of a delay in some instances. And I guess that is a question for you, Falsey, because you're the tourism minister, and the people that seem to be going to be impacted most are actually those tourism operators rather than us as Territorians. You know, like, we might feel it a little bit for some of those different fees, but those operators are obviously going to feel it a lot more, given the fact that they've gone through a really tough, you know, year with COVID, and now there's more changes coming into play that are going to impact the way in which they run their businesses.
And that's why we have deferred those fees for some of those tourism operators, acknowledging the situation they're in with some of those deferred bookings, where we've had flexible cancellation policies so that when people can travel, they get here, and also acknowledging they have to build it in. And so there has been a great deal of work between the Department of Tourism and Parks in the last couple of months since January.
I will say one thing though, Wolfie, and that is that, you know, all of us here have acknowledged in the past the seriousness of the budget situation. And I think these are the sort of things that we're going to see more of and going to need to see more of if that budget situation is rectified. Now, when the upfront cost of implementing that online booking system, you know, is going to swallow up much of the early gains, at least, then I think some serious questions need to be asked. But generally speaking, I think we're going to get to a point in the Northern Territory where we can't have everything for free anymore. We can't have our free water parks.
And I think that's a terrible shame, because if we didn't spend millions of dollars on a shade structure with vines that don't grow, and if we didn't
do like the car park,
$3 million in a playground that still hasn't been built on Miley Point, or $15 million bucks on
a
grandstand.
You like the car park. You advertise the jobs, you know, in your office with a car park in that underground spot.
You can be as funny and cheeky as you want. The reality is, you guys have blown our money against the wall. We've got $8.4 billion debt, and now you're penny-pinching from Territorians and tourists.
I've got a really good question here from one of our listeners. Wayne wants to know, Katie, can you ask, if you've booked a campsite and you find someone in your campsite, how's that going to be resolved?
Yes, Katie, that was a question I had, and I'm assured that the rangers, if you've booked that site, that's your site, and there'll be rangers around to help you secure your site.
What if you have no phone coverage and you can't contact the ranger?
I will go
to
back
say
and ask that,
that
question, because I'm really excited by this, because I genuinely...
You're really
excited chance,
because you're one of those really organised people who likes to plan everything months and months in advance.
Organisational skills.
For these spur-of-the-moment people like me and Wolfie, you know, like, we might decide on Friday afternoon, the weather's nice, we want to go camping and we won't be able to.
But when we do the Week That Was from one of our parks or tourism venues, I'll book you all a spot.
We won't be able to because there's no reception. Yeah, we won't be able to get broadcast.
I think there's
out.
A bigger issue here though, which is something I'm always very conscious of when government's changing the, you know, state of the game, is the erosion of the Territory lifestyle.
Oh, and so rubbish, we know Leah, that's it the good
serious.
Old CLP card you always pull out.
Well, it's a bloody good one, because people live here for a reason, and it's our lifestyle and it's the opportunity. And when your government's letting crime destroy the things that people love.
No,
but it's a balance. You need to have a good job to live here. You need to know that it's a safe community, and you have to have a good lifestyle.
And
when your government takes that out of whack, people will leave.
Leah, do you support the return of open speed limits?
Lifestyle.
Look, that's certainly not on our agenda. But,
yes,
you know,
or no?
This is really
well,
about.
Do you or don't
no,
you?
I said that's not on our agenda. But you know, when you start to erode people's
See, it's
lifestyle,
not nice when they all gang up on you, is it?
By, you know, making people have to pay to have a good time in our own backyard, that gets under people's nose.
Still,
you know,
in
it really
the vein,
does.
Still in that vein, I do want to talk about the changes when it comes to fishing. Earlier in the week, we do know that obviously fishos are now going to have to register to fish along more than 3,000 kilometres of the Northern Territory coast. The NLC obviously made the announcement, I should say, earlier in the week. It's going to include parts of Darwin and Bino Harbour, Anston Bay, Daly River, Port Keats and Moyle River. The NLC Chief Executive Marion Scrimgeour was on the show earlier this week, and she said that fishos would have to complete a simple and free registration process. The NLC say that they've made the decision after extensive consultation with traditional owners. I know that there has been some concerns raised about a couple of those areas that are really quite popular being off limits now, and that's what we've heard throughout the show, that people are really worried about those areas, and also how it's going to impact then the likes of, you know, some of those operators at Dundee and other places, no doubt.
This is a huge issue because, again, it comes back to lifestyle, you know, and people love their lifestyle. And the Territory government, you know, just before the election last year said they'd reached an agreement with the land councils for $10 million to push back that permit system until 2022. And, of course, now we've seen the decision from the NLC come forward around registration. And so it begs the question around how has the government let these negotiations fall apart as much as they have? And what's next? It gives people no confidence about the Gunner government's ability to ensure that people are at the table and having constructive conversations about what needs to happen going forward so that everyone's interests, you know, are being heard and are being addressed. So, again, this is an empty election commitment from the Gunner government, and we've barely heard cooey from them in response to what the NLC have come out with.
So, Katie, most areas are unaffected, but landowners have granted access to high-use intertidal waters affected by the Blue Mud Bay decision, and we do need to respect the rights of native title owners. The NLC has come up with, as you just mentioned, that simple registration process on their website, and we'll continue to work through the implementation plan with the NLC. We're certainly focused on making sure that we respect those native title rights but allow as much amateur fishing access in the territory as possible.
I mean, AFN have come out and said your government spin and more spin. I mean, what do you guys say to that?
In terms of these issues, they are difficult to negotiate, and this has been, I think, the decision's 12 years to get to this point. We, as I said, large amounts of the Territory coastline are unaffected, but the NLC has come up with this simple permit system for some areas, and we'll continue to work through with them.
But were you aware this was going to happen prior to 2022? I mean, it was less than, you know, it was about 6 months ago when you said it would be pushed out to 2022.
So this isn't within my portfolio, so I'd defer that question to the Minister.
Interestingly, there's actually fishing now falls under four different ministers, it seems like.
Because it's a token ministry. The Minister for Fisheries doesn't have a department.
Not you, Falsy. You didn't make the cut, mate. You didn't make the cut.
She's too busy being demoted from Attorney General.
Oh, Leah. Tourism.
Nothing about you could be Attorney General and Tourism Minister.
What about the other nickname you'd given her?
At least I'm Minister for longer than a week if we're going to get nasty.
Did I say it off air? What happens? Off air stays off air, Katie.
No, in Parliament, you dubbed her another.
The future Chief Minister.
The accidental leader of the opposition.
She
We're descending here, Katie. It's time for a
she called me a lot worse.
360's The Week That Was. Thanks to the Silver Hebron, your local lawyers.
You're listening to Mix 104.9's 360. It is The Week That Was. Matt Cunningham, Leah Finocchiaro and Natasha Files in the studio with us. And now we did learn throughout the week as well that there was a code yellow at the hospital last week, and Royal Darwin Hospital said that they experienced a peak in bed demand last week and as such had to enact capacity management plans. They did say that patient safety is a priority, of course, and dedicated staff at RDH work hard to ensure that Territorians welcome continue to receive the best patient-centred care possible. But I was interested, usually a media release goes out, doesn't it? On
only when it's good things,
yellow.
Katie. No, only if it's about COVID and doing something fun. If it's something serious, like a code yellow, which is a serious internal emergency which could threaten patients' safety and staff, then there's no press release for that one, no.
Katie, we did experience, RDH is one of the busiest hospitals in the country. I think everyone acknowledges that. We did see a peak in demand late last week. There was no cover up here. I met with the hospital. I was advised. I met with representatives of the health professionals. They worked through it. And so what it is, it's part of a national system. And when we get to that point, there's factors that are put in place to try and reduce that demand. So apologise if people think that it wasn't sharing information. It wasn't like that at all.
How often do they happen?
Oh, they probably happen once or twice a year, Katie, and there's no specific reason as to why the hospital was so busy. It wasn't one thing. We just see, you know, that Royal Darwin Hospital is a very busy hospital. It services a large geographical area.
How many code yellows would we have had, say, in the past 6 months?
I'm happy to go back and look at that, but I would have said one or two, but I'll make sure I get that checked before.
I guess we'll never know because there's never a press release about those types of things.
Do you know what? There was the last time I remember a press release release coming out about the Code Yellow was the same week that the $12 million was obviously announced for the grandstand. And I did wonder whether it had, you know, whether it had been a situation where last time it happened, it sort of, you know, it blew up to some degree in terms of the way in which, you know, it was reported and the way in which Territorians received that news.
What are you suggesting, Katie Wolf?
Well, that, you know,
there's been a big payment going somewhere else.
No. I'm not suggesting that. Matt can double check. But what I'm sort of suggesting is that, you know, that I understand that sometimes these things obviously, you know, create negativity or that, you know, that we sometimes, well, we do view them as being negative because we sort of Territorians then go, well, I, you know, that's right, I went there and I had to wait for however many hours. I want to point out right from the get-go, and we've been saying this all throughout the week, we know the staff at RDH do a phenomenal job. All of them, from the cleaner to the surgeon. You know, it does not matter what job you're doing. They
and
do
the
a great
staff
job.
At the Palmerston Regional Hospital, who I'm accused of slandering every time I suggest that perhaps that building that facility wasn't a great
He's
idea.
He's wearing some cupcakes out there, Matt,
But what I want to say is that I actually think it's really important in those situations, if there is a code yellow or if the hospital is really full, to actually let people know so that then, you know, you don't have someone who's got a bit of a bruised toe turning up to emergency, they go to their GP.
Yeah. Katie, we always encourage people to really think before they do present to hospital, can they access, and there's some really great telephone numbers. You've got Health Direct that can provide you with some guidance so you can talk to a professional, again, your GP, and I know that GPs sometimes get booked out as well, but I'm happy to go away from this. It certainly was not trying to hide something from Territorians. It's an extremely busy hospital. I'm happy to go away and look at a protocol around when it's appropriate, what levels to provide information to the community.
Falsey, can you tell us, because the AMA, we spoke to Dr. Robert Parker yesterday, and he said that we've still got those six surgeon positions that remain unfilled. Is that the case? And how are we dealing with that to make sure that the people around the territory that actually need to go in for a surgery are still able to be operated in a timely fashion?
So I met with the AMA last week. In terms of the six specific, I haven't had that presented to me. I do know that there is some surgeon positions that will be coming unvacant. I'm not to say that what you're saying is not correct. And I've asked if, and these are operational issues, but if they can start recruiting, knowing that it does take a while to get people in place, if that can be done as quickly as possible. I've also met the College of Surgeons, and they've been looking at innovative ways to ensure, because we do have a low population here, and so getting surgeons to come up for a period of time. The plastic surgeons have done this successfully, where they come up for a couple of months and they're able to work with our general surgeons to help them develop skills and provide that care for people in the territory. So these are complex issues, but we certainly look at innovative ways to do so.
I'm just a little bit, when you go back to the sharing of the information, I just have concerns about the sharing of information generally and the difficulty getting information from government departments and what the government does and doesn't release these days, especially given the statements that it made when it came to power about its openness and its transparency. And to quote the Chief Minister, you know, releasing this sort of information, you know, isn't just the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. And yet there are so many reports that now we can't get access to. What's happened to the Paget report into what happened at the Darwin Correctional Facility, for instance? Is that ever going to be made public? The government's had it for months. And there are various other reports. You try to access them through Freedom of Information. It's a nightmare scenario. One of them was 116 of 118 pages blacked out. When I appealed that decision or asked for a review, they said they shouldn't have released the two pages, which were the front and the back page.
It just flies in the face of this promise around scrutiny, you know, and we've seen the Gunner government on a number of occasions duck and weave and avoid these issues. It's fine to come out now, Natasha, and say, oh, you know, in the future we'll let you know. But, you know, it's pretty interesting that we can have such critical issues at our hospital and no one seemingly wants to let people know about it. I mean, I certainly received feedback from constituents who said they had to wait, you know, very lengthy amounts of time with their children at the emergency department. We saw the images in the paper last week with the ambulances being backed up. So there's some serious issues that aren't just these isolated little pop-ups. You know, there's some serious longer-term issues with supporting our health system. And again, you know, just people aren't being openly made aware of that because the government doesn't want people to know.
360's The Week That Was, thanks to DeSilva Hebron, your local lawyers.
Well, we've just about run out of time, and in the studio with us for The Week That Was this week, Matt Cunningham, Leah Finocchiaro and Natasha Files. It's always a busy week in here, there's no doubt about it. Matt Cunningham, thank you so much for your time today.
No worries, Wolfie, and big night for the under-12s tonight. Yeah, Katie, replayed you didn't, football finals.
Yeah, you missed one of the big issues of this week.
Oh, the
under 12
finals.
AFL.
You can read it all, wow, about it, all about it in the NT News Sports section today.
It's all in there.
Good luck
good
to all those
stuff,
kids.
Good stuff. Leah Finocchiaro, opposition leader, always good to catch up with you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. And I just want to do a shout out for International Women's Day on Monday, but there's lots of events going on over the weekend. I'm looking forward to having drinks and a cruise with the Women in Resources tonight. And then I'll be at Smith Street Social tomorrow. I know the Sri Lankan Society are doing something. So there's plenty on for International Women's
Day. There is. I'm speaking at something on Monday as well for the United Nations Association. Yep. Always a good day. Natasha Files, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. And talking about football, the finals tomorrow night. Nightcliff Tigers. So
go the Tigers.
Get along to Marara. Poor Leah, she's outnumbered in this room now.
Well, I'll be going for the Waratahs in the men's Premier League, Wolfie.
Will
they're
you?
On fire. Yep.
All right.
There
big
you go.
Chance.
That's a
close eye
chance.
On things. We'll keep
put money on it and blame him if you get it wrong.
You're listening to Mix 104.9.